folded, the desk shelf covered with piles of handwritten papers, and what looked like very old books. I couldn't see anyone inside, but I couldn't see the whole room either. My skin prickled with imagination, thinking of the dead-eyed Hercules silently stalking me in the dark. I edged farther down the veranda, looking over my shoulder with every other step. There was an odd sense of desertion about the place this evening. There were none of the subdued voices of slaves that had attended my earlier visit, muttering to one another as they went about their tasks. But that might mean nothing, I told myself. Most of the slaves would stop work and go to their own quarters at sundown. Still, ought there not to be house servants to tend the fire and fetch food from the kitchen? The front door stood open. Spilled petals from the yellow rose lay across the doorstep, glowing like ancient gold coins in the faint light from the entryway. I paused, listening. I thought I heard a faint rustle from inside the salon, as of someone turning the pages of a book, but I couldn't be sure. Taking my courage in both hands, I stepped across the threshold. The feeling of desertion was more pronounced in here. There were unmistakable signs of neglect visible. A vase of wilted flowers on the polished surface of a chest. A teacup and saucer left to sit on an occasional table. The dregs dried to a brown stain in the bottom of the cup. Where the hell was everybody? I stopped at the door into the salon and listened again. I heard the quiet crackle of the fire and again that soft rustle as of turning pages. By poking my head around the jamb, I could just see that there was someone seated in front of the secretary now. Someone undeniably male, tall and thin-shouldered, dark head bent over something before him. "Ian!" I hissed as loudly as I dared. "Ian!" The figure started, pushed back the chair and stood up quickly, blinking toward the shadows. "Jesus!" I said. "Mrs. Malcolm?" said the Reverend Archibald Campbell, astonished. I swallowed, trying to force my heart down out of my throat. The Reverend looked nearly as startled as I, but it lasted only a moment. Then his features hardened, and he took a step toward the door. "What are you doing here?" he demanded. "I'm looking for my husband's nephew," I said. There was no point in lying, and perhaps he knew where Ian was. I glanced quickly round the room, but it was empty, save for the Reverend and the one small lighted lamp he had been using. "Where's Mrs. Abernethy?"
"I have no idea," he said, frowning. "She appears to have left." "What do you mean, your husband's nephew?"
"Left?" I blinked at him. "Where's she gone?"
"I don't know."
He scowled, his pointed upper lip clamped beak-like over the lower one.
"She was gone when I rose this morning, and all of the servants with her, apparently. A fine way to treat an invited guest."
I relaxed slightly, despite my alarm. At least I was in no danger of running into Geely. I thought I could deal with the Reverend Campbell.
"Oh," I said. "Well, that does seem a bit inhospitable, I admit.
I suppose you haven't seen a boy of about 15, very tall and thin, with thick dark brown hair?"
"No, I didn't think you had. In that case, I expect I should be go..." "Stop!"
He grabbed me by the upper arm, and I stopped, surprised and unsettled by the strength of his grip.
"What is your husband's true name?" he demanded.
"Why, Alexander Malcolm," I said, tugging at my captive arm. "You know that."
"Indeed. And how is it, then, that when I described you and your husband to Mrs. Abernethy, she told me that your family name is Fraser, that your husband, in fact, is James Fraser?"
"Oh." I took a deep breath, trying to think of something plausible, but failed. I never had been good at lying on short notice.
"Where is your husband, woman?" he demanded.
"Look," I said, trying to extract myself from his grasp. "You're quite wrong about Jamie. He had nothing to do with your sister. He told me. He..."
"You've spoken to him about Margaret."
His grip tightened. I gave a small grunt of discomfort and yanked a bit harder.
"Yes.
He says that it wasn't him. He wasn't the man she went to Culloden to see. It was a friend of his, Ewan Cameron."
"You're lying," he said flatly. Or he is. It makes little difference. Where is he?
He gave me a small shake, and I jerked hard, managing to detach my arm from his grip. I tell you, he had nothing to do with what happened to your sister. I was backing away, wondering how to get away from him without setting him loose to blunder about the grounds in search of Jamie, making noise and drawing unwelcome attention to the rescue effort. 8 men were enough to overcome the Pillars of Hercules, but not enough to withstand 100 roused slaves.
Where?
The Reverend was advancing on me, eyes boring into mine.
He's in Kingston, I said.
I glanced to one side. I was near a pair of French doors opening onto the veranda. I thought I could get out without his catching me. But then what? Having him chase me through the grounds would be worse than keeping him talking in here.
This ends Disc 33. Voyager, Disc 34.
I looked back at the Reverend, who was scowling at me in disbelief. And then what I had seen on the terrace registered in my mind's eye, and I jerked my head back around, staring. I had seen it. There was a large white pelican perched on the veranda railing, head turned back, beak buried comfortably in its feathers. Ping Ong's plumage glinted silver against the night in the dim light from the doorway.
"What is it?" Reverend Campbell demanded. "Who is it? Who's out there?"
"Just a bird," I said, turning back to him. My heart was beating in a jerky rhythm. Mr. Willoughby must surely be nearby. Pelicans were common, near the mouths of rivers, near the shore, but I'd never seen one so far inland. But if Mr. Willoughby was in fact lurking nearby, what ought I to do about it?
"I doubt very much that your husband is in Kingston," Reverend was saying, narrowed eyes fixed on me with suspicion. "However, if he is, he will presumably be coming here to retrieve you."
"Oh, no," I said. "No," I repeated, with as much assurance as I could manage. "Jamie isn't coming here. I came by myself to visit Gillis, Mrs. Abernathy. My husband isn't expecting me back until next month." He didn't believe me, but there was nothing he could do about it either. His mouth pursed up in a tiny rosette, then unpuckered enough to ask,
"So you are staying here?"
"Yes," I said, pleased that I knew enough about the geography of the place to pretend to be a guest. If the servants were gone, there was no one to say I wasn't, after all. He stood still, regarding me narrowly for a long moment. Then his jaw tightened, and he nodded grudgingly.
"Indeed. Then I suppose you'll have some notion as to where our hostess has taken herself, and when she proposes to return."
I was beginning to have a rather unsettling notion of where, if not exactly when, Gillis Abernathy might have gone, but the Reverend Campbell didn't seem the proper person with whom to share it.
"No, I'm afraid not," I said. I've been out visiting since yesterday at the neighbouring plantation. Just came back this minute."
The Reverend eyed me closely, but I was, in fact, wearing a riding habit, because it was the only decent set of clothes I owned, besides the violet ball dress and 2 wash muslin gowns, and my story passed unchallenged.
"I see," he said. "Mm-hmm. Well, then."
He fidgeted restlessly, his big bony hands clenching and unclenching themselves, as though he were not certain what to do with them. "Don't let me disturb you," I said with a charming smile and a nod at the desk. "I'm sure you must have important work to do." He pursed his lips again in that objectionable way that made him look like an owl contemplating a juicy mouse.
"The work has been completed. I was only preparing copies of some documents that Mrs. Abernathy had requested."
"How interesting," I said automatically, thinking that with luck, after a few moments' small talk, I could escape under the pretext of retiring to my theoretical room. All the first 4 rooms opened onto the veranda, and it would be a simple matter to slip off into the night to meet Jamie.
"Perhaps you share our hostess's and my own interest in Scottish history and scholarship?"
His gaze had sharpened, and with a sinking heart I recognised the fanatical gleam of the passionate researcher in his eyes. I knew it well.
"Well, it's very interesting, I'm sure," I said, edging toward the door. "But I must say, I really don't know very much about—"
I caught sight of the top sheet on his pile of documents and stopped dead. It was a genealogy chart. I had seen plenty of those living with Frank, but I recognised this particular one. It was a chart of the Fraser family. The bloody thing was even headed Fraser of Lovett. Beginning somewhere around the 1400s, so far as I could see, and running down to the present. I could see Simon, the late and not so lamented in some quarters, Jacobite lord, who had been executed for his part in Charles Stuart's rising, and his descendants, whose names I recognised. And down in one corner, with the sort of notation indicating illegitimacy, was Brian Fraser, Jamie's father. And beneath him, written in a precise black hand, James A. Fraser. I felt a chill ripple up my back. The Reverend had noticed my reaction and was watching with a sort of dry amusement.
"Yes, it is interesting that it should be the Frasers, isn't it?"
"That what should be the Frasers?" I said. Despite myself, I moved slowly toward the desk.
"The subject of the prophecy, of course," he said, looking faintly surprised. "Do you not know of it? But perhaps your husband, being an illegitimate descendant—"
"I don't know of it, no."
"Ah." The Reverend was beginning to enjoy himself, seizing the opportunity to inform me. "I thought perhaps Mrs. Abernathy had spoken of it to you, she being so interested as to have written to me in Edinburgh regarding the matter."
He thumbed through the stack, extracting one paper that appeared to be written in Gaelic.
"This is the original language of the prophecy," he said, shoving Exhibit A under my nose. "By the Brann Seer. You'll have heard of the Brann Seer, surely."
His tone held out little hope, but in fact I had heard of the Brann Seer, a 16th century prophet along the lines of a Scottish Nostradamus. "I have. It's a prophecy concerning the Frasers?"
"The Frasers of Lovett, aye. The language is poetic, as I pointed out to Mistress Abernathy, but the meaning is clear enough."
He was gathering enthusiasm as he went along, notwithstanding his suspicions of me.
"The prophecy states that a new ruler of Scotland will spring from Lovett's lineage. This is to come to pass following the eclipse of the Kings of the White Rose, a clear reference to the Papist Stuarts, of course."
He nodded at the white roses woven into the carpet.
"There are somewhat more cryptic references included in the prophecy, of course. The time in which this ruler will appear and whether it is to be a king or a queen. There is some difficulty in interpretation, owing to mishandling of the original."
He went on, but I wasn't listening. If I had had any doubt about where Gili had gone, it was fast disappearing. Obsessed with the rulers of Scotland, she had spent the better part of 10 years in working for the restoration of a Stuart throne. That attempt had failed most definitely at Culloden, and she had then expressed nothing but contempt for all extant Stuarts. And little wonder if she thought she knew what was coming next. But where would she go?
Back to Scotland, perhaps, to involve herself with Lovett's heir.
No. She was thinking of making the leap through time again. That much was clear from her conversation with me. She was preparing herself, gathering her resources, retrieving the treasure from the Silky's Isle, and completing her researches. I stared at the paper in a kind of fascinated horror. The genealogy, of course, was only recorded to the present. Did Gili know who Lovett's descendants would be in the future? I looked up to ask the Reverend Campbell a question, but the words froze on my lips. Standing in the door to the veranda was Mr. Willoughby. The little Chinese had evidently been having a rough time. His silk pyjamas were torn and stained, and his round face was beginning to show the hollows of hunger and fatigue. His eyes passed over me with only a remote flicker of acknowledgement. All his attention was for the Reverend Campbell.
"Most holy fella,"
he said. And his voice held a tone I had never heard in him before, an ugly, taunting tone.
The Reverend whirled so quickly that his elbow knocked against a vase. Water and yellow roses cascaded over the rosewood desk, soaking the papers. The Reverend gave a cry of rage and snatched the papers from the flood, shaking them frantically to remove the water before the ink should run. "See what you've done, you wicked, murdering heathen!"
Mr. Willoughby laughed, not his usual high giggle, but a low chuckle. It didn't sound at all amused.
"Aye, murdering."
He shook his head slowly back and forth, eyes fixed on the Reverend.
"Not me, holy fella. Is you, murderer."
"Begone, fellow," Campbell said coldly. "You should know better than to enter a lady's house."
"I know you."
The Chinaman's voice was low and even, his gaze unwavering.
"I see you. See you in Red Room with the woman who laughs. See you too with stinking whores in Scotland."
Very slowly he lifted his hand to his throat and drew it across, precise as a blade.
"You kill pretty often, holy fella, I think."
The Reverend Campbell had gone pale, whether from shock or rage I couldn't tell. I was pale too, from fear. I wet my dry lips and forced myself to speak. "Mr. Willoughby."
"Not Willoughby."
He didn't look at me. The correction was almost indifferent.
"I am Yi Qing Chong."
Seeking escape from the present situation, my mind wondered absurdly whether the proper form of address would be Mr. Yi or Mr. Chong.
"Get out at once."
The Reverend's paleness came from rage. He advanced on the little Chinese, massive fists clenched. Mr. Willoughby didn't move, seemingly indifferent to the looming minister.
"Better you leave first, wife," he said softly. "Holy fella liking woman, not with cock, with knife."
I wasn't wearing a corset, but felt as though I were. I couldn't get enough breath to form words.
"Nonsense,"
the Reverend said sharply. "I tell you again, get out. Or I shall—"
"Just stand still, please, Reverend Campbell," I said. Hand shaking, I drew the pistol Jamie had given me out of the pocket of my habit and pointed it at him. Rather to my surprise, he did stand still, staring at me as though I had just grown two heads. I had never held anyone at gunpoint before. The sensation was quite oddly intoxicating, in spite of the way the pistol's barrel wavered. At the same time, I had no real idea what to do. "Mr.—" I gave up and used all his names.
"Yi Chen Cho.
Did you see the Reverend at the Governor's Ball with Mrs. Alcott?"
"I see him kill her,"
Yi Chen Cho said flatly.
"Better shoot first, wife."
"Don't be ridiculous. My dear Mrs. Fraser, surely you cannot believe the word of a savage who is himself."
The Reverend turned toward me, trying for a superior expression, which was rather impaired by the small beads of sweat that had formed at the edge of his receding hairline. "But I think I do," I said. "You were there. I saw you. And you were in Edinburgh when the last prostitute was killed there. Nellie Cowden said you'd lived in Edinburgh for 2 years. That's how long the fiend was killing girls there." The trigger was slippery under my forefinger.
"That's how long he had lived there, too."
The Reverend's face was losing its paleness, becoming more flushed by the moment. He jerked his head toward the Chinese.
"Will you take the word of the man who betrayed your husband?"
"Who?"
"Him!"
The Reverend's exasperation roughened his voice.
"It is this wicked creature who betrayed Fraser to Sir Percival Turner. Sir Percival told me."
I nearly dropped the gun. Things were happening a lot too fast for me. I hoped desperately that Jamie and his men had found Ian and returned to the river. Surely they would come to the house if I wasn't at the rendezvous. I lifted the pistol a little, meaning to tell the Reverend to go down the breezeway to the kitchen. Locking him in one of the storage pantries was the best thing I could think of to do. "I think you'd better," I began. And then he lunged at me. My finger squeezed the trigger in reflex. Simultaneously, there was a loud report. The weapon kicked in my hand, and a small cloud of black powder smoke rolled past my face, making my eyes water. I hadn't hit him. The explosion had startled him, but now his face settled into new lines of satisfaction. Without speaking, he reached into his coat and drew out a chased metal case 6 inches long. From one end of this protruded a handle of white staghorn. With the horrible clarity that attends crisis of all kinds, I noted everything, from the nick in the edge of the blade as he drew it from the case, to the scent of the rose he crushed beneath one foot as he came toward me. There was nowhere to run. I braced myself to fight, knowing fight was useless. The fresh scar of the cutlass slash burned on my arm, a reminder of what was coming that made my flesh shrink. There was a flash of blue in the corner of my vision, and a juicy thunk, as though someone had dropped a melon from some height. The Reverend turned very slowly on one shoe, eyes wide open and quite, quite blank. For that one moment, he looked like Margaret. Then he fell. He fell all of a piece, not putting out a hand to save himself. One of the satin wood tables went flying, scattering pourpourri and polished stones. The Reverend's head hit the floor at my feet, bounced slightly, and lay still. I took one convulsive step back and stood trapped back against the wall. There was a dreadful, contused depression in his temple. As I watched, his face changed colour, fading before my eyes from the red of choler to a pasty white. His chest rose, fell, paused, rose again. His eyes were open, so was his mouth.
"Same is here, first wife."
The Chinese was putting the bag that held the stone balls back into his sleeve. "Yes, he's here. Out there." I waved vaguely toward the veranda. "What he... Did you really..." I felt the waves of shock creeping over me, and fought them back, closing my eyes and drawing in a breath as deep as I could manage. "Was it you?" I said, my eyes still closed. If he was going to cave in my head as well, I didn't want to watch. "Did he tell the truth? Was it you who gave away the meeting place at Arbroath to Sir Percival? Who told him about Malcolm and the print shop?" There was neither answer nor movement, and after a moment I opened my eyes. He was standing there, watching the Reverend Campbell. Archibald Campbell lay still as death, but wasn't yet dead. The Dark Angel was coming, though. His skin had taken on the faint green tinge I had seen before in dying men. Still, his lungs moved, taking air with a high, wheezing sound. "It wasn't an Englishman, then," I said. My hands were wet, and I wiped them on my skirt. "An English name. Willoughby."
"Not Willoughby," he said sharply. "I am Yi Chang Cho."
"Why?" I said, almost shouting. "Look at me, damn you! Why?" He did look at me then. His eyes were black and round as marbles, but they had lost their shine.
"In China," he said, "there are stories, prophecy, that one day the ghosts will come. Everyone fear ghost."
He nodded once, twice, then glanced again at the figure on the floor.
"I leave China to save my life. Waking up long time, I see ghosts. All round me, ghosts," he said softly. "A big ghost comes. Horrible white face, most horrible. Hair on fire. I think he will eat my soul."
His eyes had been fixed on the Reverend. Now they rose to my face, remote and still as standing water.
"I am right,"
he said simply, and nodded again. He had not shaved his head recently, but the scalp beneath the black fuzz gleamed in the light from the window.
"He eat my soul, Tsemi. I am no more Yi Chang Cho."
"He saved your life," I said. He nodded once more.
I know. Better I die. Better die than be Willoughby. Willoughby! Ptah!
He turned his head and spat. His face contorted, suddenly angry.
He talks my words, Sammy. He eats my soul.
The fit of anger seemed to pass as quickly as it had come on. He was sweating, though the room was not terribly warm. He passed a trembling hand over his face, wiping away the moisture.
There is a man I see in tavern. Ask for MacDoo. I am drunk, he said dispassionately, wanting woman. No woman come with me, laugh, saying yellow worm point.
He waved a hand vaguely toward the front of his trousers. He shook his head, his queue rustling softly against the silk.
No matter what Waufa do, all same to me, I am drunk, he said again. Ghost man wants MacDoo, ask I am knowing, say yes, I know MacDoo.
He shrugged.
It is not important what I say.
He was staring at the minister again. I saw the narrow black chest rise slowly, fall, rise once more, fall, and remain still. There was no sound in the room. The wheezing had stopped.
It is a debt,
Yi Chang Cho said. He nodded toward the still body.
I am dishonored. I am stranger. But I pay. Your life for mine, first wife. You told Sammy.
He nodded once more and turned toward the door. There was a faint rustling of feathers from the dark veranda. On the threshold, he turned back.
When I wake on dock, I am thinking ghosts have come, are all around me,
Yi Chang Cho said softly. His eyes were dark and flat, with no depth to them.
But I am wrong. It is me. I am the ghost.
There was a stir of breeze at the French windows, and he was gone. The quick, soft sound of felt-shod feet passed down the veranda, followed by the rustle of spread wings and a soft, plaintive quah that faded into the night sounds of the plantation. I made it to the sofa before my knees gave way. I bent down and laid my head on my knees, praying that I wouldn't faint. The blood hammered in my ears. I thought I heard a wheezing breath and jerked up my head in panic. But the Reverend Campbell lay quite still. I couldn't stay in the same room with him. I got up, circling as far around the body as I could. But before I reached the veranda door, I had changed my mind. All the events of the evening were colliding in my head like the bits of glass in a kaleidoscope. I couldn't stop now to think, to make sense of it all. But I remembered the Reverend's words before Yi Chang Chua had come. If there was any clue here to where Gilles Abernathy had gone, it would be upstairs. I took a candle from the table, lighted it, and made my way through the dark house to the staircase, resisting the urge to look behind me. I felt very cold. The workroom was dark, but a faint eerie violet glow hovered over the far end of the counter. There was an odd burnt smell in the room that stung the back of my nose and made me sneeze. The faint metallic aftertaste in the back of my throat reminded me of a long-ago chemistry class. Quicksilver. Burning mercury. The vapour it gave off was not only eerily beautiful, but highly toxic as well. I snatched out a handkerchief and plastered it over my nose and mouth as I went toward the site of the violet glow. The lines of the pentacle had been charred into the wood of the counter. If she had used stones to mark a pattern, she had taken them with her. But she had left something else behind. The photograph was heavily singed at the edges, but the centre was untouched. My heart gave a thump of shock. I seized the picture, clutching Brianna's face to my chest with a mingled feeling of fury and panic. What did she mean by this desecration? It couldn't have been meant as a gesture toward me or Jamie, for she couldn't have expected either of us ever to have seen it. It must be magic, or Geely's version of it. I tried frantically to recall our conversation in this room. What had she said? She'd been curious about how I had travelled through the stones. That was the main thing. And what had I said? Only something vague about fixing my attention on a person. Yes, that was it. I said I had fixed my attention on a specific person inhabiting the time to which I was drawn. I drew a deep breath and discovered that I was trembling, both with delayed reaction from the scene in the salon and from a dreadful growing apprehension. It might be only that Geely had decided to try my technique, if one could dignify it with such a word, as well as her own, and use the image of Brianna as a point of fixation for her travel. Or, I thought of the Reverend's piles of neat handwritten papers, the carefully drawn genealogies, and thought I might just faint.
"One of the Brown Seer's prophecies," he had said, "concerning the Frasers of Lovat. Scotland's rulers will come from that lineage."
But thanks to Roger Wakefield's researches, I knew what Geely almost certainly knew as well, obsessed as she was with Scottish history, that Lovat's direct line had failed in the 1800s. To all visible intents and purposes, that is. There was, in fact, one survivor of that line living in 1968. Brianna. It took a moment for me to realise that the low growling sound I heard was coming from my own throat, and a moment more of conscious effort to unclench my jaws. I stuffed the mutilated photograph into the pocket of my skirt and whirled, running for the door as though the workroom were inhabited by demons. I had to find Jamie. Now. They weren't there. The boat floated silently, empty in the shadows of the big Cecropia where we had left it. But of Jamie and the rest, there was no sign at all. One of the cane fields lay a short distance to my right, between me and the looming rectangle of the refinery beyond. The faint caramel smell of burnt sugar lingered over the field. Then the wind changed, and I smelled the clean, damp scent of moss and wet rocks from the stream, with all the tiny pungencies of the water plants intermingled. The stream bank rose sharply here, going up in a mounded ridge that ended at the edge of the cane field. I scrambled up the slope, my palms slipping in soft, sticky mud. I shook it off with a muffled exclamation of disgust and wiped my hand on my skirt. A thrill of anxiety ran through me. Bloody hell, where was Jamie? He should have been back long since. Two torches burned by the front gate of Rose Hall, small dots of flickering light at this distance. There was a closer light as well, a glow from the left of the refinery. Had Jamie and his men met trouble there? I could hear a faint singing from that direction and see a deeper glow that bespoke a large open fire. It seemed peaceful, but something about the night, or the place, made me very uneasy. Suddenly, I became aware of another scent, above the tang of watercress and burnt sugar, a strong, putrid, sweet smell that I recognised at once as the smell of rotten meat. I took a cautious step, and all hell promptly broke loose underfoot. It was as though a piece of the night had suddenly detached itself from the rest and sprung into action at about the level of my knees. A very large object exploded into movement close to me, and there was a stunning blow across my lower legs that knocked me off my feet. My involuntary shriek coincided with a truly awful sound, a sort of loud grunting hiss that confirmed my impression that I was in close juxtaposition to something large, alive, and reeking of carrion. I didn't know what it was, but I wanted no part of it. I had landed very hard on my bottom. I didn't pause to see what was happening, but flipped over and made off through the mud and leaves on all fours, followed by a repetition of the grunting hiss, only louder, and a scrabbling, sliding sort of rush. Something hit my foot a glancing blow, and I stumbled to my feet running. I was so panicked that I didn't realise that I suddenly could see until the man loomed up before me. I crashed into him, and the torch he was carrying dropped to the ground, hissing as it struck the wet leaves. Hands grabbed my shoulders and there were shouts behind me. My face was pressed against a hairless chest with a strong, musky smell about it. I regained my balance, gasping, and leaned back to look into the face of a tall black slave who was gaping down at me in perplexed dismay.
"Missus,
"What were you doing here?" he said. Before I could answer, though, his attention was distracted from me to what was going on behind me. His grip on my shoulders relaxed, and I turned to see. 6 men surrounded the beast. 2 carried torches, which they held aloft to light the other 4, dressed only in loincloths, who cautiously circled, holding sharpened wooden poles at the ready. My legs were still stinging and wobbly from the blow they had taken. When I saw what had struck me, they nearly gave way again. The thing was nearly 12 feet long, with an armoured body the size of a rum cask. The great tail whipped suddenly to one side. The man nearest leapt aside, shouting in alarm, and the Saurian's head turned, jaws opening slightly to emit another hiss. The jaws clicked shut with an audible snap, and I saw the telltale carnassial tooth jutting up from the lower jaw in an expression of grim and spurious pleasantry. "Never smile at a crocodile," I said stupidly.
"No, ma'am, I surely won't," the slave said, leaving me and edging cautiously toward the scene of action.
The men with the poles were poking at the beast, evidently trying to irritate it. In this endeavour they appeared to be succeeding. The fat, splayed limbs dug hard into the ground, and the crocodile charged, roaring. It lunged with astonishing speed. The man before it yelped and jumped back, lost his footing on the slippery mud, and fell. The man who had collided with me launched himself through the air and landed on the crocodile's back. The men with the torches danced back and forth, yelling encouragement, and one of the pole men, bolder than the others, dashed forward and whacked his pole across the broad-plated head to distract it, while the fallen slave scrabbled backward, bare heels scooping trenches in the black mud. The man on the crocodile's back was groping, with what seemed to me suicidal mania, for the beast's mouth. Getting a hold with one arm about the thick neck, he managed to grab the end of the snout with one hand, and holding the mouth shut, screamed something to his companions. Suddenly, a figure I hadn't noticed before stepped out of the shadow of the cane. It went down on one knee before the struggling pair, and without hesitation slipped a rope noose around the lizard's jaws. The shouting rose in a yell of triumph, cut off by a sharp word from the kneeling figure. He rose and motioned violently, shouting commands. He wasn't speaking English, but his concern was obvious. The great tail was still free, lashing from side to side with a force that would have felled any man who came within range of it. Seeing the power of that stroke, I could only marvel that my own legs were merely bruised and not broken. The pole men dashed in closer in response to the commands of their leader. I could feel the half-pleasant numbness of shock stealing over me, and in that state of unreality, it somehow seemed no surprise to see that the leader was the man called Ishmael.
"Wah!"
he said, making violent upward gestures with his palms that made his meaning obvious. 2 of the pole men had gotten their poles shoved under the belly. A third now managed a lucky strike past the tossing head and lodged his pole under the chest.
"Wah!"
Ishmael said again, and all 3 threw themselves hard upon their poles. With a sucking splat, the reptile flipped over and landed thrashing on its back, its underside a sudden gleaming white in the torchlight. The torchbearers were shouting again. The noise rang in my ears. Then Ishmael stopped them with a word, his hand thrown out in demand, palm up. I couldn't tell what the word was, but it could as easily have been scalpel. The intonation and the result were the same. One of the torchbearers hastily tugged the cane knife from his loincloth and slapped it into his leader's hand. Ishmael turned on his heel and in the same movement drove the point of the knife deep into the crocodile's throat, just where the scales of the jaw joined those of the neck. The blood welled black in the torchlight. All the men stepped back then and stood at a safe distance, watching the dying frenzy of the great reptile with a respect mingled with deep satisfaction. Ishmael straightened, shirt a pale blur against the dark canes. Unlike the other men, he was fully dressed, save for bare feet, and a number of small leather bags swung at his belt. Owing to some freak of the nervous system, I had kept standing all this time.
The increasing urgent messages from my legs made it through to my brain at this point, and I sat down quite suddenly, my skirts billowing on the muddy ground. The movement attracted Ishmael's notice. The narrow head turned in my direction, and his eyes widened. The other men, seeing him, turned also, and a certain amount of incredulous comment in several languages followed. I wasn't paying much attention. The crocodile was still breathing, in stertorous, bubbling gasps. So was I. My eyes were fixed on the long-scaled head, its eye with a slit pupil glowing the greenish gold of tourmaline, its oddly indifferent gaze seeming fixed in turn on me. The crocodile's grin was upside down, but still in place. The mud was cool and smooth beneath my cheek, black as the thick stream that flowed between the lizard's scales. The tone of the questions and comments had changed to concern, but I was no longer listening. I hadn't actually lost consciousness. I had a vague impression of jostling bodies and flickering light, and then I was lifted into the air, clutched tight in someone's arms. They were talking excitedly, but I caught only a word now and then. I dimly thought I should tell them to lay me down and cover me with something, but my tongue wasn't working. Leaves brushed my face as my escort ruthlessly shouldered the canes aside. It was like pushing through a cornfield that had no ears, all stalks and rustling leaves. There was no conversation among the men now. The susurrus of our passage drowned even the sound of footsteps. By the time we entered the clearing by the slave huts, both sight and wits had returned to me. Bar scrapes and bruises, I wasn't hurt, but I saw no point in advertising the fact. I kept my eyes closed and stayed limp as I was carried into one of the huts, fighting back panic, and hoping to come up with some sensible plan before I was obliged to wake up officially. Where in bloody hell were Jamie and the others? If all went well, or worse, if it didn't, what were they going to do when they arrived at the landing place and found me gone, with traces? Traces? The place was a bloody wallow, of a struggle where I had been. And what about friend Ishmael? What in the name of all merciful God was he doing here? I knew one thing, he wasn't bloody well cooking. There was a good deal of festive noise outside the open door of the hut, and the scent of something alcoholic, not rum, something raw and pungent, floated in, a high note in the fuggy air of the hut, redolent of sweat and boiled yams. I cracked an eye and saw the reflected glimmer of firelight on the beaten earth. Shadows moved back and forth in front of the open door. I couldn't leave without being seen. There was a general shout of triumph, and all the figures disappeared abruptly in what I assumed was the direction of the fire. Presumably they were doing something to the crocodile, who had arrived when I did, swinging upside down from the hunter's poles. I rolled cautiously up onto my knees. Could I steal away while they were occupied with whatever they were doing? If I could make it to the nearest cane field, I was fairly sure they couldn't find me. But I was by no means so sure that I could find the river again, alone in the pitch dark. Ought I to make for the main house instead, in hopes of running into Jamie and his rescue party? I shuddered slightly at the thought of the house, and the long, silent black form on the floor of the salon. But if I didn't go to either house or boat, how was I to find them on a moonless night black as the devil's armpit? My planning was interrupted by a shadow in the doorway that momentarily blocked the light. I risked a peek, then sat bolt upright and screamed. The figure came swiftly in and knelt by my pallet.
"Don't you be making that noise, woman," Ishmael said. "It ain't but me."
"Right," I said. Cold sweat prickled on my jaws and I could feel my heart pounding like a trip hammer. "Knew it all the time." They had cut off the crocodile's head and sliced out the tongue and the floor of the mouth. He wore the huge, cold-eyed thing like a hat, his eyes no more than a gleam in the depths beneath the portcullised teeth. The empty lower jaw sagged, fat-jowled and grimly jovial, hiding the lower half of his face.
"The Igungun, he didn't hurt you none?" he asked.
"No," I said, thanks to the men. Ah, you wouldn't consider taking that off, would you? He ignored the request and sat back on his heels, evidently considering me. I couldn't see his face, but every line of his body expressed the most profound indecision.
Why are you being here?
He asked at last. For lack of any better idea, I told him. He didn't mean to bash me on the head, or he would have done it already when I collapsed below the cane field.
Ah, he said, when I had finished.
The reptile's snout dipped slightly toward me as he thought. A drop of moisture fell from the valved nostril onto my bare hand, and I wiped it quickly on my skirt, shuddering.
"The missus not here tonight," he said at last,
as though wondering whether it was safe to trust me with this information. "Yes, I know," I said. I gathered my feet under me, preparing to rise. "Can you, or one of the men, take me back to the big tree by the river? My husband will be looking for me," I added pointedly.
"Likely she be taking the boy with her," Ishmael went on, ignoring me.
My heart had lifted when he had verified that Gili was gone. Now it fell with a distinct thud in my chest. "She's taken Ian? Why?" I couldn't see his face, but the eyes inside the crocodile mask shone with a gleam of something that was partly amusement, but only partly.
"Missus likes boys," he said, the malicious tone making his meaning quite clear.
"Does she?" I said flatly. "Do you know when she'll be coming back?" The long, toothy snout turned suddenly up, but before he could reply, I sensed someone standing behind him and swung around on the pallet. "I know you," she said, a small frown puckering the wide, smooth forehead as she looked down at me. "Do I not?" "We've met," I said, trying to swallow the heart that had leapt into my mouth in startlement. How do you do, Miss Campbell?" Better than when last seen, evidently, in spite of the fact that her neat wool gown had been replaced with a loose smock of coarse white cotton, sashed with a broad, raggedly torn strip of the same, stained dark blue with indigo. Both face and figure had grown more slender, though, and she had lost the pasty, sagging look of too many months spent indoors. "I am well, I thank you, ma'am," she said politely. The pale blue eyes had still that distant, unfocused look to them, and despite the new sun-glow on her skin, it was clear that Miss Margaret Campbell was still not altogether in the here and now. This impression was borne out by the fact that she appeared not to have noticed Ishmael's unconventional attire, or to have noticed Ishmael himself, for that matter. She went on looking at me, a vague interest passing across her snub features. "It is most civil in you to call upon me, ma'am," she said. "Might I offer you refreshment of some kind? A dish of tea, perhaps? We keep no claret, for my brother holds that strong spirits are a temptation to the lusts of the flesh."
"I dare say they are," I said, feeling that I could do with a brisk spot of temptation at that moment.
Ishmael had risen, and now bowed deeply to Miss Campbell, the great head slipping precariously.
"You ready, Bibby?" he asked softly. "The fire is waiting."
"Fire?" she said. "Yes, of course," and turned to me. "Will you not join me, Mrs. Malcolm?" she asked graciously. "Tea will be served shortly. I do so enjoy looking into a nice fire," she confided, taking my arm as I rose. "Do you not find yourself sometimes imagining that you see things in the flames?"
"Now and again," I said.
I glanced at Ishmael, who was standing in the doorway. His indecision was apparent in his stance, but as Miss Campbell moved inexorably toward him, towing me after her, he shrugged very slightly and stepped aside. Outside, a small bonfire burned brightly in the center of the clearing before the row of huts. The crocodile had already been skinned. The raw hide was stretched on a frame near one of the huts, throwing a headless shadow on the wooden wall. Several sharpened sticks were thrust into the ground around the fire, each strung with chunks of meat, sizzling with an appetizing smell that nonetheless made my stomach clench. Perhaps 3 dozen people, men, women, and children, were gathered near the fire, laughing and talking. One man was still singing softly, curled over a battered guitar. As we appeared, one man caught sight of us and turned sharply, saying something that sounded like "ha." At once, the talk and laughter stopped, and a respectful silence fell upon the crowd. Ishmael walked slowly toward them, the crocodile's head grinning in apparent delight. The firelight shone off faces and bodies like polished jet and melted caramel, all with deep black eyes that watched us come. There was a small bench near the fire, set on a sort of dais made of stacked planks. This was evidently the seat of honour, for Miss Campbell made for it directly, and gestured politely for me to sit down next to her. I could feel the weight of eyes upon me, with expressions ranging from hostility to guarded curiosity, but most of the attention was for Miss Campbell. Glancing covertly around the circle of faces, I was struck by their strangeness. These were the faces of Africa, and alien to me. Not faces like Joe's, that bore only the faint stamp of his ancestors, diluted by centuries of European blood. Black or not, Joe Abernethy was a great deal more like me than like these people, different to the marrow of their bones. The man with the guitar had put it aside, and drawn out a small drum that he set between his knees. The sides were covered with the hide of some spotted animal, goat perhaps. He began to tap it softly with the palms of his hands, in a half-halting rhythm, like the beating of a heart. I glanced at Miss Campbell, sitting tranquil beside me, hands carefully folded in her lap. She was gazing straight ahead into the leaping flames, with a small, dreaming smile on her lips. The swaying crowd of slaves parted, and 2 little girls came out, carrying a large basket between them. The handle of the basket was twined with white roses, and the lid jerked up and down, agitated by the movements of something inside. The girls set the basket at Ishmael's feet, casting awed glances up at his grotesque headdress. He rested a hand on each of their heads, murmured a few words, and then dismissed them, his upraised palms a startling flash of yellow-pink like butterflies rising from the girls' knotted hair. The attitude of the spectators had so far been quiet and respectful. It continued so, but now they crowded closer, necks craning to see what would happen next, and the drum began to beat faster, still softly. One of the women was holding a stone bottle. She took a step forward, handed it to Ishmael, and melted back into the crowd. Ishmael took up the bottle of liquor and poured a small amount on the ground, moving carefully in a circle around the basket. The basket, momentarily quiescent, heaved to and fro, evidently disturbed by the movement or the pungent scent of alcohol. A man holding a stick wrapped in rags stepped forward and held the stick in the bonfire until the rags blazed up bright red. At a word from Ishmael, he dipped his torch to the ground where the liquor had been poured. There was a collective "ah" from the watchers as a ring of flame sprang up, burned blue, and died away at once, as quickly as it came. From the basket came a loud "ah-ah-ah-ah-ah-ah." Miss Campbell stirred beside me, eyeing the basket with suspicion. As though the crowing had been a signal, perhaps it was, a flute began to play, and the humming of the crowd rose to a higher pitch. Ishmael came toward the makeshift dais where we sat, holding a red head rag between his hands. This he tied about Margaret's wrist, placing her hand gently back in her lap when he had finished. "Oh, there's my handkerchief," she exclaimed, and quite unself-consciously raised her wrist and wiped her nose. No one but me seemed to notice. The attention was on Ishmael, who was standing before the crowd, speaking in a language I didn't recognize. The cock in the basket crowed again, and the white roses on the handle quivered violently with its struggles. "I do wish it wouldn't do that," said Margaret Campbell, rather petulantly. "If it does again, it will be 3 times, And that's bad luck, isn't it?
Is it?
Ishmael was now pouring the rest of the liquor in a circle round the dais. I hoped the flame wouldn't startle her.
Oh, yes, Archie says so. Before the cock crows thrice, thou wilt betray me. Archie says women are always betrayers. Is that so, do you think?
Depends on your point of view, I suppose, I murmured, watching the proceedings. Miss Campbell seemed oblivious to the swaying, humming slaves, the music, the twitching basket, and Ishmael, who was collecting small objects handed to him out of the crowd.
I'm hungry, she said. I do hope the tea will be ready soon.
Ishmael heard this. To my amazement, he reached into one of the bags at his waist and unwrapped a small bundle which proved to hold a cup of chipped and battered porcelain, the remnants of gold leaf still visible on the rim. This he placed ceremoniously on her lap.
Oh, goody,
Margaret said happily, clapping her hands together.
Perhaps they'll be biscuits.
I rather thought not. Ishmael had placed the objects given him by the crowd along the edge of the dais. A few small bones with lines carved across them, a spray of jasmine, and two or three crude little figures made of wood, each one wrapped in a scrap of cloth, with little shocks of hair glued to the head nubbins with clay. Ishmael spoke again. The torch dipped, and a sudden whiff of blue flame shot up around the dais. As it died away, leaving the scent of scorched earth and burned brandy heavy in the cool night air, he opened the basket and brought out the cock. It was a large, healthy bird, black feathers glistening in the torchlight. It struggled madly, uttering piercing squawks, but it was firmly trussed, its feet wrapped in cloth to prevent scratching. Ishmael bowed low, saying something, and handed the bird to Margaret.
"Oh, thank you," she said graciously.
The cock stretched out its neck, wattles bright red with agitation, and crowed piercingly. Margaret shook it.
"Naughty bird," she said crossly, and raising it to her mouth, bit it just behind the head.
I heard the soft crack of the neck bones and the little grunt of effort as she flung her head up, wrenching off the head of the hapless cock. She clutched the gurgling, struggling, trussed carcass tight against her bosom, crooning,
"Now then, now then, it's all right, darling,"
as the blood spurted and sprayed into the teacup and all over her dress. The crowd had cried out at first, but now was quite still, watching. The flute, too, had fallen silent, but the drum beat on, sounding much louder than before. Margaret dropped the drain carcass carelessly to one side, where a boy darted out of the crowd to retrieve it. She brushed absently at the blood on her skirt, picking up the teacup with her red-swathed hand.
"Guests first," she said politely. "Will you have one lump, Mrs. Malcolm, or two?"
I was fortunately saved from answering by Ishmael, who thrust a crude horn cup into my hands, indicating that I should drink from it. Considering the alternative, I raised it to my mouth without hesitation. It was fresh distilled rum, sharp and raw enough to strip the throat, and I choked, wheezing. The tang of some herb rose up in the back of my throat and into my nose. Something had been mixed with the liquor, or soaked in it. It was faintly tart, but not unpleasant. Other cups, like mine, were making their way from hand to hand through the crowd. Ishmael made a sharp gesture, indicating that I should drink more. I obediently raised the cup to my lips, but let the fiery liquid lap against my mouth without swallowing. Whatever was happening here, I thought I might need such wits as I had. Beside me, Miss Campbell was drinking from her teetotal cup with genteel sips. The feeling of expectancy among the crowd was rising. They were swaying now, and a woman had begun to sing, low and husky, her voice an offbeat counterpoint to the thump of the drum. The shadow of Ishmael's headdress fell across my face, and I looked up. He too was swaying slowly, back and forth. The collarless white shirt he wore was speckled over the shoulders with black dots of blood and stuck to his breast with sweat. I thought suddenly that the raw crocodile's head must weigh 30 pounds at least, a terrible weight to support. The muscles of his neck and shoulders were taut with effort. He raised his hands and began to sing as well. I felt a shiver run down my back and coil at the base of my spine where my tail would have been. With his face masked, the voice could have been Joe.